So our final speaker is Howard Griffiths, who's a professor of plantology, plant sciences, and co-chair of the Cambridge Global Food Security IRC here at Cambridge. And after many delays, he's here. We're glad to have you. And he's going to be talking about the domestication of wild pine, how the pineapple works the night shift. I'm really intrigued.
Well, thank you very much, Andrea. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me, and I do apologize to you all for my late return as storm approached Delhi and our flight was delayed. And I also appreciate the way that you've manipulated the timetable to fit me in. And I'm feeling a little bit out of place, but I hope I'll try to bring a little bit of context, because I understand that we've heard so much about these very deep philosophical thoughts about our interaction and understanding of food and this relationship between food and famine. We've heard in the session this afternoon about the socio-economic exploitation, the potential environmental catastrophe that goes with a very much intensive agriculture, and we're using pineapple as an example here, but of course one could apply this to many other crops that are grown in intensive areas. And what I'd like to do on behalf of the pineapple is perhaps present the case for the pineapple itself, which is the biology of the pineapple. And what I would like to present to you this afternoon is the way that the pineapple experiences feast and famine on a daily basis. And so perhaps we'll sort of be able to finish the day off with that sort of take. So first of all, I should say that, I'm going to talk a little bit about where I came to start working with the elements of the pineapple through wild pine, which are the relatives of pineapple. And I want to take us on a little journey, both my own historical journey through the forests of Trinidad, through to where pineapple evolved and how it became to have been adopted, and where in the Americas it came from. And then just some insights as to some of the amazing discoveries that we're now getting by the latest molecular sequencing in understanding how not just pineapple is evolved, but also many other plants that you'll find interesting and popular. So my journey has taken me through Trinidad, through working with many folk who I'm extremely grateful to have had the opportunity of liaising with, the herbarium in Trinidad, and it's given me many adventures, as you can see, and I still don't seem to have learned quite how to keep my feet on the ground, even in the last few years. Journeys right through into the heart of the forests in Trinidad, and searching for wild pine. Trinidad represents an island just off the coast of South America, with a very wide range of habitat from the northern mountain range, which isn't much more than 1,000 metres, 3,000 feet in height, but has a huge range of habitats. And within that, we find a huge range of the relatives of the pineapple, as well as, of course, pineapple itself. But these are wild pine, rather than the domesticated pineapple. And so I've been very fortunate in having first visited Trinidad in 1981, to have an extremely bright research student, Jane Mayles, who was pictured on the previous slide there, who was fascinated with bromeliads, which is the family that pineapples come from, the Bromeliaceae, and in particular allowed me to follow some questions that we first observed in 1981 about the distribution of some of these epiphytes. So these are the wild pine that sit up in trees. They're almost the rainforest hitchhikers, and yet they occupy very important niches. And so what we've been doing in the last 5 to 6 years is quartering the northern mountain range of Trinidad, mapping the distribution of some key species, and their the relation to the triassic gradients that we find within the mountain region. But why this fascination, and why this night shift, I hear you ask? Well, first of all, we also have to go on an even bigger journey, and that's to remind ourselves of the range of succulent plants that one can find across many, many semi-arid habitats. And for instance, there's a euphorbia from Africa, there's a saguaro cactus from the Sonoran Desert on the border between the United States and Mexico. This is a view from my own that I took in Venezuela, probably back in 1983. And these plants represent succulents in that they are plants which store water in succulent tissues, but individually they have succulents in that their individual cells are large so that they can store that water, but also engage in a rather peculiar form of photosynthesis, whereby they don't perform, as we've heard a lot about maize and potato and how important they are. Well, these plants work the night shift. And the reason they work the night shift, as you can see here, I'm not going to take you through a technically complex diagram, but other than saying that pineapple, together with the perhaps the plants you may well recognise growing on the walls around your gardens and so on, the stone crops and so on, or this this partially plant that agave we've got there. Well, you'll be aware that many plants normally open their leaf pores by day to take up carbon dioxide to make sugars to grow, and they use the power of sunlight, and that's what photosynthesis is all about. But as you can see from this diagram, complicated diagram, stuff happens in the dark for these succulent plants. And they open their leaf pores in the dark. And I think I have a diagram here, a simple diagram. They open their leaf pores in the dark, and that's when they take up their carbon dioxide. But of course, there's no sunlight, so they can't make sugars in the dark. They have to store that carbon dioxide as an acid, which is why the leaves of all of these plants, or the succulent stems in those other plants that you've seen, become more acidic overnight. They build up an acid which, well, historically we'd associate with the apple, malic acid. That builds up in the cells overnight, so that the leaves become progressively more and more acidic as the night goes on. And so if you actually want to understand the rate and magnitude of their activity in relation to the stresses that they're living in, the stressful environment, you can imagine for those semi-desert plants, water is very limiting. You may think that water is not limiting in a tropical forest, but of course, epiphytes use branches to hold on to reach up into the sunlight. And so effectively, they cannot reach soil water, so they store water, but they also often have this inverted pathway. So what the plants then do is, because they lose less water when they take up their carbon dioxide at night, they then close those pores by day, and rather strangely, they regenerate the carbon dioxide, but this time effectively behind the closed doors. So the leaf pores are closed, and the carbon dioxide can then be produce a rich environment within the leaf, but the enzyme that fixes carbon dioxide and provide, well, it's the basis for life on Earth, that is then able to work at a more efficient level in order to acquire and turn some of those extra sugars, carbon dioxide, into sugars which can then fuel growth, using the sunlight which is then available. And so we have this inverted temporal separation of these two, what we call carboxylation processes, because they both involve two separate rates of fixing CO2 into different chemical compounds. And so that's why these plants work the night shift. Now, as you can see in this opening, this slide here, which I took just last, I think it was the Saturday before last, I think, this is preparing for one of my lectures. And it is one of the things I try to treat the 1A students with every year, is a taste of pineapple, as you can see. I'm a dab hand now, I can cut and course a pineapple, but I can do about 8 in an hour, very comfortably. And here is the note that goes with it, so that's that diagram that I briefly showed you. So that's the science which I teach the 1A students about the way that these plants operate. And I should say, incidentally, that at the same time as having plates of pineapple left through the lecture theatre, they also get bags of popcorn, because that comes from maize. And this illustrates the point about these two contrasting photosynthetic pathways that both improve the operating efficiency of photosynthesis compared to our humble potato that we heard about, or rice or wheat that we heard earlier. So maize and sweet corn and sugarcane have an additional form of mechanism by which they improve photosynthesis. So this just takes one on a very fascinating journey whereby you have to stay up late. Obviously, in those first expeditions, I was climbing trees throughout the night in order to sample leaves so that we could work out the rate of change of the acidity of the leaves. And it is that strange fascination and sheer bloody-mindedness that both the plants have and that one needs to have if one's going to be a researcher to work on them. But increasingly we're understanding huge amounts about more detailed biochemical and molecular regulation of fundamental plant processes. All that we've learned through fundamental plants that you've heard so much about over the past 2 days, such as the pineapple. And it's also taken me on very many long journeys. So what I want to do, I'm not quite sure how much you've heard about where pineapples come from, But I think this is now going to give you some deep history, because I know your conference has been focused very much on more recent aspects of the feast and famine and the way that pineapples have been associated with dining and so on and the whole social interactions that they've come about. But the pineapple, as you will realise, is not one of these epiphytes. It's actually a ground-dwelling bromeliad. And so it's a member of the Bromeliaceae, and whilst most of the bromeliads, and many of them, you may see them as houseplants, as tinandas and so on, air plants, they're often sort of, the terrestrial version have developed fleshy fruits, and the argument there is because they evolved in the understory of the forest canopy, and whilst their epiphyte counterparts could shed their seeds and blow them on the wind, these plants developed fleshy fruits that would allow the seeds to be dispersed by the animals that would be on the ground. So it made a lot more sense to have them like that. Over the last few years, this is a paper from 2014 from Thomas Giddish and colleagues, we now use molecular analyses to understand much more detail. And again, this is where the pineapple originated from. It originated in the Brazilian shield here. And there are a number of other subfamilies within the Bromeliaceae which originated in different parts of South America. There's many fascinating tales that I could tell you for another hour or more, but I appreciate that time is of the essence. But nonetheless, the huge question about the uplift of the Andes leading and the repeated glaciation, aridity and then tropical development, tropical forests, has led to the diversification. So there are now around 3,000 species found in the Bromeliaceae, and the pineapple is found in the most advanced family within the Bromeliaceae. And of course, there are many examples of horticultural varieties which have also been selected, in addition to the one that we've been hearing so much about, culture, which has been turned into such an important crop. So I think you may also have had other speakers who've mentioned this, but again, we think that the pineapple actually was domesticated between, well, certainly by 3,000 years before present, and probably between 6,000 and 10,000 BC. Why shouldn't it have been? If in the fertile present, mankind was domesticating wheat and selecting wheat and barley and millet, of course, around about the same time, it's equally likely that this should have happened here. I find it rather quaint that reading some of the papers in 30, 40, 50 years ago, there were explanations about trying to think about how it wasn't really thought that anybody, that trying to identify the origins of the pineapple without recognising that it too would have been subject to the same selective pressures, probably in terms of picking those tastier, more juicy fruits for the previous 10,000 years that they were already being recognised would have been happening in the eastern side, in the near east. So, I think you've already heard some rather tragic and shocking stories about the way that the Columbus discovered the pineapple and the way that in turn then was distributed. And you've just been hearing now about the huge and terrible pressures that are being created, both in terms of socio-economic terms, in terms of exploitation of labour, in terms of environmental catastrophes associated with the mass production of these plants. And I think that this are really important points to focus. But again, I just want to finish with this one sort of take-home message. And because the pineapple has recently been sequenced, you may remember that the human genome was sequenced with the great fanfare maybe 15 to 20 years ago with a huge amount of effort. We're now able to sequence genomes rather more frequently and rather much more quickly because of the advanced technology. But what we now see from this sequencing of the pineapple genome is that it actually has given us huge insight for how other closely related plants have evolved. And it is it's a monocot, so it's in the same family as grasses, orchids, and the Agaraceae, Liliaceae, in fact. And what we've learned from this is a diagram taken from the paper which described the molecular sequence of the pineapple, but it also helps us identify the co-evolution and origins, not just of ananas, but also important crops like banana, agave, asparagus, and orchids indeed as well. So, and these all seem to have diversified about 100 million years ago. But I think the particular thing, and then of course we have some of these grasses coming on later that have been exploited by man. But the key thing I would say about the Brumiliaceae and the way that they have evolved and diversified, particularly with this development of this strange Crassulacean acid metabolism, or CAM, which is the name of this inversely cycled pathway, is that that probably has been emphasized in the last 5 million years. It's a relatively recent adaptation, which came about because of the reduced CO2 that occurred over that time and the need to cope with that, and the need to cope with the increasing aridity that was happening in these habitats. So this is why and how pineapple and its close relatives are able on a daily basis to cope with the famine of water supply and allow a feast of carbon dioxide to be delivered to that important enzyme to drive photosynthesis. So I'm going to stop there. I'm just going to show a couple more, I think one more set of pictures, of rather gratuitous pictures of some of my colleagues with whom I've collaborated over the years in pursuit of the cousins of the pineapple. So thank you very much.